Atheist Nomads episode 349, normal local business and my own story.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. And a bit later, I'll be actually sharing my own story, which, yeah, if you've been listening for a long time, you've picked up bits and pieces here and there, and if you've listened to my guest appearances on other podcasts, you've probably heard me tell my story there. But I've never actually told it here. And it was kind of one of those things where I would have at the beginning, but I wanted to keep it short because most of the listeners were coming from podcasts that I'd already told my story on. And then I just never got around to it in almost 8 years. So, yeah, I figure, you know, we're almost 350 episodes in. I might as well actually properly introduce myself. Oh, man. But before that, though, we do have news. And, yeah, as much as coronavirus is taking over all of the news for basically everything, Idaho is still, you know, being Idaho. So, as of right now, in Idaho, child sacrifice and child marriage are both legal, and trans people are considered basically people. Half of that has changed, or will be soon, as a handful of bills go into law. Ah, fucking Idaho. The perennial bill to, or bills to remove the religious exemption for medical neglect, which I prefer to call by what it really is, religious child sacrifice in the most brutal means possible, because it would be more humane to slit your child's throat to please your God than to let your child die drowning of pneumonia or from an infection or from diabetes. Nope, that can't be banned because parental rights. So yep, that one, still legal. As long as you never take your kid to the doctor, you can let your kid die. Last year, there was a bill to finally set a minimum age for marriage in the state of Idaho. Most states have gotten with the times, you know, sometime in the 20th century. Idaho still hasn't. Well, hadn't. With literally no minimum age for marriage. At present, it would be legal for me to marry off Kylie. She's not even 2.5. Last year's bill was rejected as violating parental rights because it would have required a judge to sign off on the marriage of anyone 16 or 17 and prohibit any marriages under the age of 16. The new bill is a little bit softer than that. It still sets the minimum at 16, and parental consent is the only thing required for a 16 or 17-year-old to get married. So at least they were able to get a majority of the state legislature to agree that 14-year-olds should not be getting married, and that 2-year-olds definitely should not be getting married. But they weren't able to all agree on whether or not parents have a right to force their 16 and 17-year-old daughters to get married because they get pregnant. Because that's all that has to do with. This is fucking bullshit. When you're passing a minimum age for marriage law in the 21st century, it needs to be a hard 18. Pure and simple, it just has to be a hard 18. Even the Middle East is starting to catch up with this. And Idaho's going with a soft 18, hard 16, which is fucking ridiculous. Oh, wait, they did add in one extra little benefit, but an extra little protection. The maximum allowable age difference between the parties getting married, if one is under the age of 18, is 3 years of age. A 16-year-old girl can marry her 18-year-old boyfriend that knocked her up, but not a 21-year-old. And only if the parents consent to it. Which, if you're going to allow marriage, parental consent should never be a factor. Parents should never have to be involved in that consenting. If you need parents to consent to it, it should not be allowed at all. if the parties getting married cannot consent on their own, that is not a real marriage. It is disgusting and it is gross and it is, we are, should be way past this. So, okay, we haven't taken care of child sacrifice and we've only halfway taken care of child marriage. Oh, and I do want to make it clear that this is a huge, huge improvement. Setting it down to making it difficult for underage, and let's be honest here, underage girls to get married. Making it very difficult, very restrictive. I think they should have kept the judge aspect, but in all practicality, even having a judge sign off on it is absurd. So maybe that's good that they got rid of that. But it is a step in the right direction, and it is improvement, and it will greatly reduce, and I don't even know what the numbers are on how many teenage girls are getting married in Idaho, but I know it does happen. And at least this is, yeah, this is a step in the right direction. So it's a soft win. But Idaho also passed, and the governor has signed into law just in time for Trans Awareness Day, two laws that explicitly deny recognition of trans people. These bills were a big enough deal that they got into CNN's Five Things email. Like the only not coronavirus or economic meltdown story to make CNN's Five Things bill. This was a big enough deal to get covered by most major media outlets. The two bills, which are now going into law. The first one, it came from House Bill 500, and it's called the Fairness in Women's Sports Act. Yeah, it's not about women's sports and it's not about fairness. Let's just make that clear. It says, and I quote, athletic teams or sports designed for females, women, or girls shall not be open to students of the male sex, end quote. They specifically chose the word sex instead of gender, and it went on to clarify how to resolve a dispute about an athlete's gender or sex, with the remedy being examining, quote, the student's reproductive anatomy, genetic makeup, or normal androgenously 19 produced testosterone levels. So if you have higher than typically found in women testosterone levels, if you have a penis or testicles, or if you have a Y chromosome, you cannot take part in women's sports. The concept here is that trans women would have advantages athletically over cis women, under the assumption that trans women aren't women, they're men. And there's not really, for one, it's not really a problem that's really happening. There aren't, like, the percentage of the population that is trans is minuscule. The percentage that are taking part in athletics is even smaller. And the amount of them, and just the sheer number who would be screwing up what they claim the big issue here is athletic scholarships, is a rounding error at best. This is all about denying that trans people exist and punishing them for being who they are. This is bullshit, and it's ridiculous. And I don't think they really necessarily get how bad it is. Actually, no, I think they do. I think they do know how bad it is, and the goal is to just make it so that trans people don't take part in sports. This is explicitly just to punish trans people. Especially paired with the other bill that Governor Little signed into law on Monday, which started out as House Bill 509. It prohibits transgender people from updating their gender identity on their birth certificates. This is the second attempt for the state to enact a law to this effect. The first one was struck down in federal court in 2018. So the ACLU of Idaho is already speaking out against this and has pointed out that the first bill is in direct violation of the Idaho High School Activities Association regulations. This would be the first state in the country to pass legislation against trans students. And the ACLU will be suing. So, and these bills will probably both be struck down. I know what the objective here is. It's no different than Texas and Ohio and a handful of other states trying to use coronavirus delaying elective procedures to stop abortions and the various fetal heartbeat bills and embryonic heartbeat bills and all the like with those. It's get as many into the courts as possible, as McConnell has, and just Republicans in general, have spent Obama's entire administration thinning out the courts as much as possible so that Trump could fill as many seats as possible, leaving us in the position where a quarter of all federal judges are Trump appointees, so that they can get as many bills into the courts as possible so that one passes the test as being reasonable enough. And the real target is to have something that is reasonable enough for a Supreme Court where John Roberts is the moderate swing vote. And when your moderate swing vote is as far right as John Roberts, that bar is pretty low. So, yay, Idaho. Now, in other local news, we had a magnitude 6.5 earthquake on March 31, day of recording. It was about 3 hours ago, actually, as of recording. Magnitude 6.5, about 80 miles away. It was actually only about 20 miles from where Lauren and I got married, just northwest of Stanley. And from the reports I've seen, very, very little damage. Some broken windows in Stanley. Like a couple old chimneys have lost some bricks in Boise. Nothing too major. We smelled gas outside right after the earthquake in our neighborhood. And the gas company came out and checked it out. Actually, three of us in the neighborhood called them about it because we all smelled gas. So they've checked that out. And yeah, we're clear in that regard. We're definitely expecting aftershocks. This is a pretty big earthquake. The last one of this magnitude in the state was in the 80s and caused the highest point in Idaho to rise about 10 feet in elevation and a city in Idaho to drop 8 feet in elevation. So this is a little bit weaker. I think that one was a 7.2. This is just a 6.5. But it'll be interesting to see what the end result of this one ends up being and how the aftershocks look. Because we have no idea what those are going to be like. So far from what I've seen, today, it's been a bunch of, you know, 2.7, 3.8, a 4.3, nothing getting even close to that 6.5, but we'll see how the next few days go. Should be interesting, but yeah, it was shaking pretty strong here in the house for about 30 seconds. There was a little pause in the middle and then it started right back up again. And yeah, it was a pretty interesting earthquake. And in other news, the live stream will be Saturday, April 4 at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. It'll be on YouTube and there will be a link that you can find on the website at atheistnomads.com/live. I'll also be sharing it out on Facebook and Twitter. So come join us for that. We'll be live streaming episode 350. It'll be a lot of fun. And then after episode 350, there's going to be some changes to the podcast. Nothing drastic, although I did consider more drastic changes. We're going to be going more towards single focus episodes. And not necessarily every week. Some weeks there will be more than one episode, and some weeks there won't be an episode. Most weeks there will be something by Thursday, but again, not always. And so there will be some episodes that will be longer dusting off the degree segments, probably closer to 30 minutes, which some in past episodes have gotten that long. I'll shoot for actually just fleshing them out intentionally to be that length. And then that will just be its own standalone episode. And these news rants, I'm having a hard time keeping them short. So I will allow myself the time to do longer rants, dig deeper into stories, and take 25 or 30 minutes to talk about a news story or a set of news stories that are similar or a couple of news stories that really caught my attention. We'll have interviews in the mix, and this is just, trying to do more interviews I've found has been difficult to keep up on scheduling. So cutting down the number of interviews will help with that, cutting that back down again. And I do like talking about the news. Not all of the news will be me solo, but most of it probably will. With a 2-year-old, life can be hectic, and it can be hard for Lauren and I to both be available for recording. So this will free up a lot more flexibility, and I think it'll be a good change for everyone. So keep listening, and give me some feedback on what you think about it. It will also help doing shorter standalone stuff or less timely, longer episodes will make it easier for me to schedule working on the podcast. It'll make it easier for me to do some of these as quick little single day or single evening after Kylie goes to bed. I record and edit and release it all at once. It should be a lot easier on the family to do it that way. And then the not timely stuff I can do whenever I have time to do it and work on those separately. This should be good. And I did get another episode of Schisms out. This one is actually the first one on the early Christianity. So not early Christianity, but early Christianity, about the time period when Christianity was still a Jewish sect, prior to the schism between Christianity and Judaism, which we'll be getting into in the next two episodes. So check that out at schismpod.com or religiondivided.com. And then I'll take a quick break, which for me will actually be a whole day, and then come back where Lauren should be with me, and we'll be going through my story. All right, so I am now joined by Lauren and Kylie.
Professional interviewer, Lauren.
Now, okay, before we get into that, though. How could you tell she was clipping? You weren't even looking at it. You don't have monitors on.
Because she was yelling into the microphone.
But with the earthquake, since it's now been a day since it happened.
Oh, man. So much fun.
We have more damage reports.
Okay. Well, not local. Not here. That's right. You remember the earthquake? You remember the shaking yesterday? She's trying to put the microphone in and eat.
Okay. So the Cathedral of St. John the Evangelist.
Yeah, the one right downtown on State Street.
Yep, I believe that's Episcopal. The earthquake cracked the cross on the top of it. They are hoping that they can salvage the cross, but they are still very happy that it wasn't destroyed.
Well, that's good. Moroni did not drop the trumpet, but St. John's cracked a cross.
Yep.
Okay.
And we didn't talk about it when it happened, but Salt Lake's earthquake a few weeks ago, the Angel Moroni at the temple in Salt Lake.
I thought we mentioned it at least once. Oh, boy.
It drops. We cut the story before recording, not...
Can you imagine the poor sucker that got hit by that thing?
Oh, man, yeah.
That's like, an act of God, if I've ever heard of one.
Apparently, God hates churches.
Well, apparently... churches are just old and shoddily built. Actually, no, they're very well built, but they're old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and like, I saw somebody make a and I retweeted it. A note that there wasn't any reports of the Boise Meridian or Twin Falls temples losing Moroni's trumpets. Those are all much newer.
Yeah.
Probably built to earthquake code. Unlike Salt Lake.
Okay, so Boise's Moroni temple, Moroni statue is probably the original. I'm sure they didn't redo that when they renovated.
Right, yeah.
Because, you know, a dude holding a trumpet is a dude holding a trumpet. It doesn't need a new face. But it's just recently been replastered and reset. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there was, yeah.
But also
right.
still a much newer temple than the one in Salt Lake.
Yep.
That's the original from, what, the 1850s?
Yeah, but I'm sure they do renovations all the time.
The trumpet's an integral part of the statue itself. They're probably not touching that as much.
That's true.
But anyway, so yeah, apparently God hates churches, and there are people freaking out about Yellowstone because earthquakes keep happening within a few hundred miles of Yellowstone.
I wish I had the time or even the energy to go back and find that first article that talked about the super volcano and how it could blow at any minute. Ever since they published that article, it's been every person who has, you know, a high school geology background is, oh man, it's gonna blow.
This just happens to be a geologically active area.
Yeah, we've actually been, I'm surprised we haven't had more earthquakes here. Considering, you know, This is more of a wait and see kind of state versus the constant releases you get in like California. Heck, even off the coast of Oregon, there's always little earthquakes off
little
there.
Little ones, but we have little earthquakes around all over Idaho all the time.
Well, yes.
It's just when we have big earthquakes, it's, you know, 6.5, 6.9 out in the middle of nowhere. Salt Lake's 5.7 was like right in town.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. Yeah. You have to admit that's probably way more. What was the term? Intense?
Yeah.
Cause more damage than, yeah. Still, I wish I could feel it again.
We probably will. They are projecting aftershocks to continue for about a year. So we will probably feel more.
Also cuts our camping area a little short, doesn't it? Oh, well.
COVID-19 is doing that for us. All right. So, and now for the main topic, now that we're halfway through. Lauren, do you want to?
Oh, so Dustin's brought up that he's never brought up his story. I mean, you've referred to it in, you've discussed it on other podcasts.
Uh-huh.
You've described it, bits of it here and there throughout the entirety of your podcast. But here we're at 49 episodes, and you've never actually sat down and just told your tale?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's start with family background.
All right, so as far as I can tell, the Williams family was pretty irreligious until my grandparents in Caldwell.
Idaho,
yes. The Clark family, and the Williams side, you know, they all immigrated to the colonies, not even necessarily English colonies, in like the 1600s, a few in the 1700s. The Clark family moved to the U.S. from England in the 1860s.
Okay. Oh, during that whole, I think that's when a whole bunch of my Welsh family came over. They were all converted to Mormonism and came over.
Completely unrelated, though.
Unrelated, but same time period.
Yeah, same time period. And the Clarks were already religious outsiders, even in England. They became Baptists in the 1600s, which is about as early as they were Baptists. And my great-great-great-grandfather got kicked out of the Southerly Mills Baptist Church. Now, he owned the mills of Southerly Mills. So, not an insignificant figure in the community or church.
What did he do? Who did he do?
And his family had been in that church since it started 200 years prior. What he did was bigamy.
Oh!
So, kind of like your Mormon ancestors, but...
Ha ha, yeah.
Not Mormon. Yeah. Marrying just one wife wasn't enough, so he married her sister as well. Well, didn't quite marry, but she moved in, and they have a three-sided tombstone that they all share.
Aww,
in Iowa.
That's kind of sweet, yeah. But only if it worked out.
Apparently it did. they lived happily together until wife number one died, and then he married wife number two legally, and then I think he died, and then she died, and they're all buried with a single three-sided tombstone.
Okay, so got kicked out of the church for having too many women's.
Yep, and continued to sit in his pew every Sunday.
Oh, he wouldn't give up, huh?
Nope. He had been disfellowshipped, and he kept going. Then his son married a rival's daughter, and they packed up after they got married and moved to the U.S., and the rest of the family followed, but they're the more, these two, my great-great-grandparents, are the more critical ones for this tale. They moved to, eventually to Nebraska.
Nebraska?
Mm-hmm. They were in Nebraska in the 1880s when an Adventist missionary came to town. And by this point, the Adventist Church had kind of been around for about 40 years in some form. At that point, more accurately, the Advent movement had been around for about 40 years. The Adventist Church officially had been in existence for about 20.
Okay.
And a missionary shows up in town and starts asking around, who's the most respected man in town? And they all said, J.R. Clark. So the missionary went to John and Fanny Clark's door, knocked on the door, and invited himself in. And they sat down and studied, and my great-great-grandfather became converted and joined the Adventist Church.
Was this, do you think that this was religiously motivated or was it business motivated?
There would have been no business benefit of it.
Oh, okay. Because in a lot of areas, they try to build up a community that way.
No, the Adventist way of doing it was very much spread out as much as possible. The very opposite of the Mormon approach. Like, in many ways, Adventists and Mormons, as similar as they are opposites of each other. In so many ways. then around 1900, he made a deal with God that if
sorry.
If somebody offered him a land trade, he would accept the trade and go to where this land is and build a school for the church.
Was that common then for land trades to somebody say, hey, I've got some land over in...
Sometimes, I guess.
Okay.
It was a thing.
It's kind of cool.
And he got a land trade deal and moved to just north of Battle Creek, Washington, which is just north of Portland, Oregon.
Oh, okay. Just right outside the Vancouver area?
Yeah. Just above Vancouver. So, yeah, just across the river from Portland is Vancouver. And then just up from Vancouver is Battleground. And then just up from Battleground is... where they got this field. It was wooded land.
That sounds picturesque.
He kept half of it for himself and half went to the church. He cleared the land and built a lumber mill, sold lumber, used lumber to build the school and the church and his house.
Oh, that's a good area for that.
Sold off a bunch of the lumber to help pay for the other materials they needed and founded Columbia Adventist Academy, which still is in existence. It is no longer a boarding school. It is just a day school. But it was a boarding school for a long time. A Adventist community formed around where they settled, as happens when there's schools. And John and Fanny are the first two names on the church charter for the Meadowglade Adventist Church.
Okay. Founding members.
In 2006, I went as part of the family delegation for the 100th anniversary of the signing of the church charter. Southwestern Washington is in the Oregon Conference of the Adventist Church.
Okay.
And the Meadowglade Church is the, I believe, largest church in the Oregon Conference still. If it's not largest, it's second largest. So anyway, that's how my family got started. And so my family was actively involved in the Adventist Church from then on. And I was fifth generation Seventh-day Adventist. And in 1982, my mom got Hodgkin's lymphoma. And this was still pretty early days of cancer being successfully treated. She went to Misty in downtown Boise at St. Luke's. That was the only place you could get cancer care in the region at that time. And there were two doctors.
And they were in Vail, mm-hmm. Oregon, right?
Mm-hmm. Family farm, 8 miles north of Vail. So it was, at that time, a 90-minute drive each way. And she had to do that 5 days a week for both when she was doing radiation and chemo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that sucks. But life-saving. Mm-hmm. You got to know Misty as a kid then, huh?
Yep. Yeah, we went. Actually, I'd get dropped off at the children's hospital and just hang out in the waiting room there watching TV.
That was a few years before you were born, though.
That mm-hmm. was... Yeah, so that was before I was born. And then at the end, my mom was told that she would not be able to have any more children. That wasn't a big deal. She already had three. And if she were to get pregnant, the resulting baby would probably be stillborn or have severe birth defect. That's based on the information they had back then. When my mom got pregnant, it was a complete surprise.
Whoopsie, and baby.
She kept it secret from everyone for the entire first trimester. And part of the reason
did your dad know?
Nope.
Wow. Okay.
She kept a secret from everyone for the first trimester because everyone would have told her to get an abortion because she should have gotten an abortion.
Yeah.
She had three children she needed to take care of. And yeah, that was a reckless, unnecessary risk that she took. And at the time, the Adventist Church was very much pro-choice, as were most Protestants. And Adventists continued to be pro-choice officially until last year. So she knew that everyone in the family and the church would have been telling her to get an abortion. So she kept it secret and believed that I was a gift from God, a miracle baby that was a gift from God. And then I was born perfectly healthy.
Hey, major statistic there, by the way.
And yes,
you're a data point somewhere.
A very important statistic. I later, when I moved to Boise, I met a woman who had, her mom had had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma treated at Misty the year after I was born.
Wow.
Her mom was not told that she'd have any trouble having children after that. What had changed in that time period was me.
Aw. And because of you, lots of babies were born healthy and happy. And
since then, I've looked into the data that's been collected at that time, about 30 years since I'd been born. And what all the research showed is that cancer, yes, it depends on the type of cancer and the type of treatment as to what effect it has on fertility. But on average, it cuts fertility in half and doubles the chance of birth defect.
Oh, wow.
So if you cut fertility in half, it takes the chance of getting pregnant from taking on average a year to taking on average 2 years. And it takes the chance of birth defects from being
minuscule to slightly more minuscule.
About 2 in 1,000 to 4 in 1,000.
Okay.
So yeah, pretty insignificant. I didn't have that information until I was 30.
Right.
All those years that I was a miracle.
Yeah.
Not an interesting data point in that shows that life finds a way.
I believe it's life finds a way.
Yeah.
You have to have an in there. Okay, so fast forwarding a little bit, you were about your young childhood out in Vail until about 8 years old.
Yep.
You were just a good little boy, right? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
Good little farm kid.
Good little farm kid. And then your life changed big time.
Yes. So when I was 5, my father left. My mom got married again when I was 8, and we packed up and moved to Grants Pass. So from far eastern Oregon to far southwestern Oregon, but not on the coast, which would have been cooler. And I went from public school to an Adventist school, and theoretically, everything should be great in an Adventist school. I was the new kid, and I was smarter than everybody, and I was too stupid to not keep
play
that
dumb
from being obvious. Like, I challenged the teacher and entire class on whether China or Russia was bigger on our map that had the Soviet Union on it. It was 1992. Maps still mostly had the Soviet Union on them in classrooms. And I correctly outlined where Russia was on the map and convinced everybody that, yes, Russia is still bigger than China.
Wow.
At 8.
I mean, I want to beat you up. I mean,
yeah.
That's...
So I went from being the new kid to the new kid that was getting bullied. And then after that, I ended up just being the kid who got bullied. So all new kids every year after that got to be the cool kids by joining in on bullying me. And it wasn't always just name calling and practical jokes. It was often stealing stuff from me and physical violence.
Boys being boys, as what they used to call it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's bullshit, by the way. How did that affect your religion, religious views?
It drove me deeper into it.
You felt like that was something that protected you, or...
I felt that Jesus was my only friend.
Oh, well, that's what they tell you, right?
Yep. So that all continued until seventh grade, when... that's when it started to change, when the violence got to the point of being life-threatening. And I was in the computer lab playing Oregon Trail, and a classmate came up behind me and started choking me. And I tried to get him off, and eventually got him off of me and turned around and punched him in the face. And he ran off with a bloody nose. You don't need the step stool.
Go sit on Elmo.
Couple weeks later, it happened again with somebody else, and he tried to choke me. Again, I was playing Oregon Trail in the computer lab, and he came up behind me and started choking me, and I got him to let go and gave him a bloody nose.
Yeah, that sounds about right for that age. One kid can't do it, another kid's going to step up and try to do it.
Oh, yeah. And, like, I don't advocate fighting back to bullies, but when it's life-threatening, yes, fight back to save your life.
Yeah. Or, you know, increased bodily harm. I mean, obviously you don't want to just sit back and let somebody break your leg, but right. That was a very tough lesson for you.
Yeah. And then I ended up setting the rule for myself that if you touch me, I will punch you in the face. And it's amazing how when that's how you respond to bullying, it stops fast. It also helped that around that time, I became the tallest person in the class and eventually the tallest person in the school.
Yeah, that probably helped a lot.
Yeah. I found once I hit 6 foot, nobody ever touched me again.
Yeah.
Even the one time I was involved in a bar fight, nobody touched me.
Which has its own little effects. But yeah. Okay, so as you approach high school, graduation...
Yes.
Adulthood.
So, I then
you were full bore.
I got to the end of my the junior academy that I was going to, which only went to 10th grade, and talked my parents into sending me to Milo, the Adventist boarding school in southwestern Oregon.
You talked your parents into sending you away to an Adventist boarding school.
Yep.
Dedicated.
Yep.
Because that costs money.
Yep. And I had to work and got a tiny percentage of my minimum wage job for myself. Yeah, I had to...
They worked kids there.
Yes, everybody there had to work. Yeah, working is not an option. Even the rich kids had to work.
That's kind of nice. I mean, there's something about that. Never mind the permanent physical damage that working in a lumber mill causes, but...
The poor kids worked in the mill.
Yeah.
The rich kids did not.
Okay.
The rich kids worked campus jobs, you know, teacher's assistants and RAs and cafeteria and janitorial stuff. And the poor kids worked in the lumber mill, getting permanent hearing loss. And then senior year was senior survival. And we...
This still blows my mind that Adventists do that.
And apparently it's not all Adventists, but at least in the Western United States, Adventist high schools do this. For us to go to the wilderness, we only had to go 5 miles from campus because Milo was built in the wilderness as an apocalyptic school with the plan. Like they built it in the 50s, believing it didn't need to survive the decade.
And yeah, so, because everybody believes the end of the world is right around the corner.
Yeah.
What's on your hand?
So then...
She's doing very good check-ins.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a campus that you've got big steep mountains on one side and a river on the other. The only way on or off the campus is a covered bridge.
So, I mean, it's a good thing they're teaching you survival in case there's a freaking natural disaster or even just a broken bridge.
No, the survival training was for hiding from the government in the end days.
Goddamn crazy.
Yeah. 1 week of training on how to survive on wild edibles, how to trap rodents, skin them and cook them.
Red Dawn shit up in here.
How to build survival structures based on what you have available where you are.
Actually, I think everybody should do this. This sounds like a great high school
and
class.
How to watch for the signs of the end days.
That's a little weird, but
we got up there on a Sunday. Tuesday morning was when the one classmate that was missing got back from a family wedding in Texas, and the principal brought him up, picked him up at the airport in Medford, and then drove up and brought him to camp. And the principal came and pulled the pastor aside that was leading the spiritual survival class, where we were learning about how easy it will be to be deceived in the end days.
Oh, okay.
And the principal whispers something in his ears, and then he comes back and says, "What if I told you terrorists hijacked a plane and flew it into the World Trade Center?" And he went on to describe the September 11 terrorist attacks as a what if.
What would you do?
What would you say? What would you think?
End of times, right? This is
everybody's response was, "I wouldn't believe it."
Oh, you just wouldn't. Oh, deception.
Especially since we were just learning about how easy it will be to be deceived in the end days. And here we have somebody with these crazy hypotheticals. And like, I had just 8 weeks before that, I had been on a tour of the Pentagon. I had walked through those halls, a plane flying into that. No, not a chance. One of those flights that was described, DC to LA, a month before those attacks, I had been on that flight. No, that couldn't happen. No. And then he was like, it happened. And nobody believed him.
That guy is an asshole, by the way.
The principal had to come out like, no, this is real. This really did happen.
You should find that. Is that pastor still around? I mean, I would be like, by the way, that was really effed up what you did to us.
One of my classmates married him.
Oh my God. He was double dipping.
And they bragged, and they didn't kiss at the end of the wedding vows and after the I do, because they thought it'd be weird for their first kiss to be in front of everybody.
Oh, one of those purity wedding, purity love things.
Yeah.
That pastor's effed up. Wait, how old was this guy?
40.
But so much is wrong. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so...
So we get the
radio.
You
were affected by September 11th in a completely different way than most kids that time.
Not only was there the psychological torture of the way it was presented to us, but I had been on the flight, one of those flights, and I'd been in one of those places just before it. Like, that felt very real. There were lots of Adventists, myself included, who dug into Ellen White's writings to try to see, you know, is this prophecy? And Ellen White had a vision she wrote about of all of the skyscrapers in New York burning to the ground.
Well, okay, so two down.
I think it ended up being actually five when it was all said and done. They took down some of the smaller ones. But yeah, and where we were was also right underneath the major north-south west coast flight path. So that entire, you know, the days up to that point, every time you looked up, you saw a jet or a contrail. Always.
Yeah.
And then we looked up and nothing. And you look up again and nothing. And you look up again and nothing. And they didn't cancel senior survival. We continued on. There had been a lot of discussion as to whether or not they should cancel it and send everybody back to campus or send everybody home. And the decision was, what benefit would there be of that? And if you're worried about the student's safety, it doesn't get much more safe than a survival camp in the wilderness.
In some ways, that's safer. Okay.
From a terrorist attack, that's not a target.
Yeah, that's true.
So we finished senior survival. By the time we got to campus, they weren't showing the planes crashing into the towers anymore. So I didn't actually see any video footage of that until 6 or 8 months later.
Lucky.
Everybody else I know saw it for all week, and they finally stopped like the day before we got back to campus.
Yeah.
So then about 2 weeks later, I started feeling a sense of calling to the ministry. That started during week of prayer on campus. They brought a pastor in to lead sermons every single night and every day in the middle of the day all week. And
exhausting.
I believe the end times were here, that my conclusion reading the Bible, you know, reading in Revelation and reading Ellen White was that that was the one of the trumpets. I don't remember which trumpet it was, but there's one that, it's opening of the seals. There's one where Revelation says that when they opened it, there was silence in heaven for 30 minutes. And if you follow the day to a year prophecy numerology practice, then
oh my God.
30
yeah.
minutes works out to 1 week.
Yep. Crazy kid.
So I concluded that, yep, that's the end is right here. And I believed that God was calling me to help prepare the world for the end days. And I didn't want to do that. So I resisted. Then spring break, we did a mission trip in Cancun.
Poor baby.
Mission trip in Cancun for spring break. What were they thinking?
Cheap flights?
Yeah.
They were thinking, well, you guys didn't get anywhere near any of that.
Nope.
So, I mean, that's kind of too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, so we...
Probably cheap flight packages, honestly.
We had a pastor with us who did an evangelistic series, and we helped with Vacation Bible School that was going on at night and worked on construction for a church building. A lot of cement work. I hauled a lot of bags of cement. Unbeknownst to me at the time, I had pneumonia and was doing heavy construction work, cement work with pneumonia. There is one night that I can look back on and be like, oh yeah, that's the closest I've been to death.
Wow.
I had to be propped up with like 10 pillows to keep from coughing when I tried to lay down that night.
And they didn't just send you home, of course.
Nobody,
they couldn't.
Nobody knew what was going on. Nobody thought anything was wrong with me. I thought I just had a cold. And then I got bit by a poisonous spider. And I had a friend lance the boil that formed on my left big toe. And then the next day we got torrential rain and had to walk through 3 feet of water to try to get to where the trucks could pick us up to take us back to the hotel.
Wow.
3 feet of water in the slum side of Cancun. The water was brown and very murky and not clean. The infection started almost immediately. The swelling really started to pick up. I got to a doctor the next day, and they lanced it and tried to clean it out without any anesthesia. That was absolute agony. When I got back to the States, my mom picked me up at the airport and took me straight to the doctor. She was expecting me to be hospitalized. It was that bad.
Yeah. Lucky you didn't die. That's the kind of stupid, stupid mistakes that these mission places do that get kids killed.
So I concluded that was God punishing me for resisting the calling to the ministry. And then I got a Air Force ROTC scholarship offer. I had applied for that. I'd been in Civil Air Patrol since I was just shy of 13, and I wanted to be an Air Force officer.
Yeah.
And I got offered an Air Force ROTC scholarship, and I prayed about it, and God told me, go to Walla Walla, take theology. So I turned down the scholarship, went to Walla Walla as a theology major.
Yeah, God really dropped the ball on that one.
It's interesting looking back on it as, you know, how could I have thought that God was actually speaking to me when, oh yeah, I had pneumonia. I had pneumonia for 2 months and didn't know it. It wasn't diagnosed until another week after that. I was on 2.7 grams of antibiotics a day.
Yeah, you were loopy.
I was
not
well.
No life decisions made when you're that sick.
Yeah. And yeah, so I turned down that scholarship and went to Walla Walla, studied theology, and the doubts started my freshman year.
Oh, right off the bat.
Yep. every year I was about ready to change.
You guilt-tripped yourself into it.
Yeah.
And then had, like, buyer's remorse.
Yeah. Every year I was about ready to drop out. Well, change majors, not drop out of college. I was going to just change. I was looking at pre-law at that point. And I would figure out some way of making it all make sense and brush the doubts away. But ultimately, it was the same doubts that kept coming back over and over again. It was around stuff around evolution and, you know, origins issues, the authority of scripture and salvation.
Which is what where most doubts start.
Yeah, those three things. And they just kept coming back over and over and over and over again. Most of the, I'd say about a third of my senior year of my undergrad, I would not have honestly considered myself a Christian. Most of my time in the seminary, if I'd been honest, I wasn't a Christian. But I wasn't honest with myself or anyone else about it. I couldn't be. I didn't get
your whole life was set up to
be. When I went to that 100th anniversary celebration for the church that my great great grandparents had founded, went at overflow seating, which ended up being the front row, right next to the conference vice president, who I'd had a job interview with about 2 months before, and I'd seen him also just at a meeting at the church I'd grown up at, where he came to help mediate a disagreement between the pastor and elders. And he told me that I all but had the job. So just wait for the call. I'd have a job as a youth pastor somewhere in Oregon. And
you waited.
And I waited and I waited and I didn't get it. And then I got to sit next to him and we sat there through the service. And then at the end, I turned to him and I said, 2 months ago, you told me to expect a job offer. What happened?
He knew as soon as he sat down next to you, he's like, God damn it.
Yeah, he knew who I was. He recognized me. He was not wanting to talk about that. And yeah, so he had to explain that, yeah, they just like the students from Southern better.
Wow.
Yep.
So it was a school affiliation thing?
There was a trend in the Oregon Conference to recruit pastors from Southern in Tennessee, not from Walla Walla in Washington.
Too close to home.
Walla Walla is known as the liberal Adventist college.
Ah.
Southern is known as the conservative Adventist college.
Okay.
As I heard it described at the time, Walla Walla teaches you, well, Southern teaches you what to believe. Walla Walla teaches you how to think.
Oh, well, yeah, that's going to cause trouble.
And I don't disagree with that either, because, yeah, they taught me a lot of critical thinking. That definitely helped contribute to me going through a lot of doubts. Walla Walla's program also did encourage having doubts and working through them, because what you would expect somebody coming out of high school to have faith and knowledge wise versus a pastor is very different. And to build up what you would want a pastor to have, you need to basically destroy everything that was there before.
Right. The naivete.
Yeah. And so I wasn't sponsored to go to the seminary. My classmates at the seminary who were drawing full salaries, or at least a decent stipend, had housing and tuition and everything all paid. The tuition was super cheap, heavily subsidized by the church, but still had to pay tuition and living expenses. So I went to the seminary in Michigan. I was there 3 semesters. Went through about 40% of the Master of Divinity program. And the only reason I didn't drop out at the end of the first semester was it was December, and I would have had to pack up all my stuff and move back to Oregon from Michigan. And I had seen all of the places where they can close down I-80 all the way across Wyoming.
Yeah.
And I did not want to drive across Wyoming in the winter.
No. Smart move.
Yeah.
Sucks, but smart.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd looked at an alternative of driving down through Texas and Arizona, and it's just like, that's too far. And then I'd still have to drive through the Siskiyous and New Mexico. New Mexico's got some crazy mountains too. And it was just like, that didn't look very good. And my parents had already bought an airline ticket for me to fly home for Christmas. And it was just like, nope, I'll just stick it out another semester. I ended up deciding to making it through that next semester and not dropping out barely. I signed up for an archaeological dig in Jordan and a mission trip in Cancun.
The first time wasn't bad enough for you?
Nope. And my conclusion was that, or my determination was that I would either, by the end of that travel, getting out of the classroom, getting to see the world, getting to preach an evangelistic series, that either my faith would be restored or I would leave the church, but I would know for sure. And I almost backed out of the evangelistic series when I was in Jordan. They sent out an email giving everybody a chance to back out, and I came so close to, but I decided, no, I still need that. That's the last chance, because I got to Jordan and got to see a bunch of sites from the Bible, and it was all just so tiny.
It's a small region when you are,
yeah,
from the Western United States.
Like all of that, like all of the stories of the Bible. Okay. Actually, heck, all of them would fit in the Northwestern United States. 90% of them would fit into an area about the size of the Treasure Valley.
Wow. Yeah.
It's a tiny, tiny area, and it was really eye-opening, and none of it was really inspiring.
Not the restoration of faith that you were hoping for.
Right. Like, I went to Jerusalem and walked down the Via Dolorosa and went to the grotto at Gethsemane and climbed the Mount of Olives and felt nothing. And then finished up that trip, went to Mexico and started preaching an evangelistic series. Had a translator, prepared slides. It was sponsored by ShareHim. We talked about them a few weeks back.
Mm-hmm.
And I got 4 sermons in, and I couldn't keep preaching. I hadn't believed a single word that came out of my mouth. I hadn't been convinced by anything I said. And I can
kind of beat a dead horse at that point.
Yeah, I can.
It's hard to let go, though.
Well, and at that point, it was very much, if I was wrong, I wasn't doing anybody any favors because I wasn't convincing anyone, even myself. And if I was right, I wasn't doing anybody any favors because lying to people is not a good thing to do. So I barely slept that night after that 4th sermon, got up the next morning and talked to my roommate. And then we went to the morning gathering of all the people. There was about 20 different, about 20 people in the group. I think it was about 15 different sites around the greater Cancun area where people were preaching. And I talked to the people running it afterwards, and I told them that I wasn't a Christian anymore. Couldn't keep doing it. And by the we talked for about an hour, and by the end of it, they thanked me for my integrity and wished me the best. And I walked away.
Well, not literally.
No, not literally.
You were stuck there.
I was stuck there for another.
That's really
two
awkward.
And a half weeks. Stayed in the same room because I couldn't afford to go to a private room, and couldn't find a better rate anywhere else.
Yeah. But, yeah, that was the end of...
Yeah. It was really awkward around the hotel.
Yeah, I bet. But then you went on to, what, smoke your first cigar, drink your first drink?
I had my first beer that night. Within a few days, I was snorkeling with French girls and smoking cigars.
Not a bad way to end a trip.
No, it wasn't.
No. Saved Cancun for you.
Mm-hmm. So then I wrapped that up. I got back to Michigan and I finished up just a little bit of coursework. I figured it'd be better to not have an F.
If in case you ever wanted to go back into school or...
Yeah. And so I finished up a little bit of coursework that I had and then packed up my stuff and left. I ended up resigning from 4 things in one day while I was wrapping things up. I was working with a church in the area, helping teach one of the Sabbath school classes. So I met with the pastor there to resign that position. I was deputy commander for cadets with the local Civil Air Patrol unit, and I had to resign that position. I was a student dean in the dormitories on campus, so I had to resign that. And I had been elected president of the chaplain's club at the seminary. Aww. So I had to resign that.
That's rough. That's really nailing the nail in the coffin there.
four resignations in like one or two days. Oh man, it was, that was rough. And yeah, finished wrapping everything up, sold off some stuff, gave away a bunch of books, and drove back to the Northwest, got a job in Tacoma. So I ended up moving up there. They transferred me to Everett. So I moved up to Everett, Washington. And then they transferred me to Boise. So I moved here.
You've been stuck here ever since.
I was supposed to be here for less than a year. Yeah. No. It hasn't been bad.
How did your parents react to you coming home?
It was awkward. And I think it was the second or third time I came back. Like, I kept moving around a lot. Couch hopping and then going back home for a little bit. And then I'd couch hop around job interviews.
Oh, so you didn't just move back
people.
In with your parents?
No. I didn't really stay in any one spot more than 3 or 4 days.
Oof.
I spent a month literally, yeah. I was flat broke, unemployed, and couch hopping.
Wow.
Job interview to job interview. And so it was one of the times I got back to Grants Pass. And I couldn't even move back into my old room. My sister had taken that. So when I was there, I was staying out in the trailer. And my mom eventually sat me down on the front porch and was like, all right, you quit the seminary. What else have you quit?
Yeah.
And that ended up being a very uncomfortable conversation. And at the end, she tried pinning it on debt. It was all financial issues because I was taking student loans to feed myself.
Yeah.
That was a consideration. That was an active encouragement to quit as opposed to stick it out for nothing.
Yeah.
It encouraged me to come to a conclusion, but it wasn't a part of the decision. And she eventually called it a delayed teenage rebellion. At which point I said, Mom, I have a bachelor's degree in theology and just spent 3 years in the seminary. I know your religion better than you do. And you think this is a delayed teenage rebellion? And I got up and walked away.
Yeah, that really belittles what you went through, but a parent has to try and come up with something.
Yeah.
When religion is as important to family as it is to yours.
Yeah.
I mean, your parents, your stepdad and your mom even met through
the church.
Through the church. So yeah. It's just like there was no escaping it.
Right. Yeah. And when after that conversation, we never talked about it for... Like, I finally mentioned the word atheist in passing on the phone with her when I was in Everett, shortly before moving to Boise. It was almost 3 years before it even came up at all. A few years later, my mom would ask me advice for some church politics issues they were dealing with. Since I'd studied it, I knew the stuff, and yeah, I was happy to try to help her navigate that. It was around the time I moved to Boise that I started blogging. By that point... that was around the time I was also starting to be a guest on Chariots of Iron. I was on that podcast, I think, 5 or 6 times. I think we recorded 6 or 7 times. I think 5.
Well, things happen.
Yeah. And then I was on Living After Faith, which I've been on that show now twice. Once in like 2010 and once in, I think, last year. And I started blogging mostly because I was getting tired of people that I'd known before finding me on social media and asking me what happened and having to try to explain it over and over and over again.
So you made yourself a copy-paste form?
So I wrote out a blog so I could just give them the link.
There you go.
And once I did that, people would just go to the blog and they stopped asking me. And then the blog eventually turned into the podcast and here we are.
Wow. And how would you say you've changed in the past 5 years? 8 years now?
I am not as angry.
Is it just because it's dulled from age or is it because you've accepted and grown past certain things?
I honestly believe that everyone who was a true believer and is now an atheist has a lot of trauma and pain and has to work through the anger. there is a multi-year often grieving process.
Yeah.
And you have to work through that. And like in my case, a big part of it was going, like I had to go through rethinking everything I believed and every value I held.
The basis for your very existence.
I had to rework all of that.
Yeah.
And figure out, is this justifiable? And it was a long process. For an example, at the point that I started the podcast, I was conceptually okay with gay people. I still wasn't comfortable with gay people. I was barely even aware of trans people and really uncomfortable with trans people. And then started talking to people who are gay and trans for the podcast, or people that we know in person, have met in person here, and discovered, no, these are just, they're people just like everyone else.
Yeah. Seeing people who use social services because they really were struggling to get by.
Yeah, that was one when I was in Everett, having employees that were single moms who couldn't, if not for welfare programs, they wouldn't be able to work. And that was a real, oh, wait, yeah, okay. All of a sudden, it all started to make sense. The social safety net. Yes, there are people that are stuck relying on the social safety net. But without the social safety net, they're never going to be able to improve their situation at all.
Yeah. So, yeah, you've changed a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Any advice you'd give to some kid out there? Some 15-year-old who...
Who is a believer or a baby atheist?
Oh, actually, I guess just any advice you would give for baby atheists, no matter what age.
Go through the process. It's easy to think that once you've left your religion, that the process is over. The deconversion process, that's done. You still have a process you have to go through, and you need to take your time and actually work through it. Don't try to rush it. Let yourself feel the feelings you need to feel, and let yourself give yourself the time to work through reevaluating everything, and don't shortchange yourself by trying to find shortcuts.
Okay. That's pretty much up. All caught up.
Yeah. All right. So, that's it for this week. And, we'll be doing the live stream this Saturday. So check us out at 8:30 PM this Saturday. And hopefully Lauren does not have an allergy attack.
I've been getting, it's like, 6 o'clock, bam, every day. This sucks. Anyway.
Yep. All right. Well,
live long and prosper, people.
Yeah. And remember, not all those who wander are lost.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads, and like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.